You're listening to Grove Street Journal.
Enjoy the show.
And we're live. Welcome back to another episode of the Grove Street Journal. Really excited for today's episode. I am joined by Dr. Eric Janusen. And Eric has studied at the University of Victoria, studying chemistry, got his undergraduate there, went on to complete a PhD in chemistry there, and then headed over to Glasgow to do some postdoctoral studies, machine learning, AI, data analytics, that was studying with the Cronon Group, I believe. And now he's here with me today as the lead chemist at Delic Labs. This is a laboratory in BC, Canada, and they are doing some awesome stuff in the fields of cannabis and mushrooms. So without further ado, Dr. Eric, welcome. Thank you for being here today.
Hi, Francis. Thanks so much for having me on.
Oh, my pleasure. As I say, I've been looking forward to this episode for a while now. I talk about this a lot on the podcast, and to anyone that'll listen, to be honest with you, Eric, the biggest benefit of cannabis legalization in Canada has been the dissemination of information around terpenes, yes, cannabinoids, and like we were just talking about, it's completely changed my relationship with cannabis. I make optimized decisions now. I never have bad experiences with cannabis. And the only thing that's changed is my access to consistent information when I'm buying product.
Right. Yep. We're at a place now, especially in Canada, where it's okay to talk about it. It's okay to openly study, or I shouldn't say openly, still have to be licensed and all that, but it's okay to explore something that's usually been kind of taboo and a little bit tough to get accurate information on. It's already a complicated topic. It's a plant, and analyzing plants is difficult. Getting an accurate picture of them is difficult because they grow in many different situations and turn out completely different. But even so, what we're able to do now with a little more of an open license to study it is incredible. We're allowed to access it and explore it in really robust scientific fashion.
And it's not just cannabis that you're studying. So you have an application to study, I think, DMT, LSD, obviously cannabis, psilocybin. Is there anything else I've missed off that list?
I don't know if you've admitted psilocin, 5-methoxy-DMT, 4-hydroxy-MET, like the list goes on. And I say that we're in bat country now, right? I don't know if you've seen Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, but when they crack open the trunk of the back of Hunter S. Thompson's car, it's kind of what I'm looking at, it seems, some days, you know. All kinds of controlled substances, including psychedelics and cannabinoids, are on the list. And we do a lot of other analytes. Obviously, we look at everything that's inside the plant, a comprehensive analysis, but we're licensed to look at all of these controlled substances. So we're here to support the cannabis industry and the growing, relatively new psychedelic industry as well.
Wow, that's an impressive portfolio of substances. Yeah, that's a great scene. I've got my hands together in glee as a teenager, and here as I am as an adult doing the exact same thing. Like, oh, that's brilliant.
I'm doing the same thing, but I'm just wanting to measure them, right?
But that's exactly what we need to understand more about these things. So that's such an important thing. How difficult is it to study these forbidden fruits? Is it pretty difficult to get licensing for this kind of thing?
Yeah, it is difficult, and I think it should be, right? You should have to jump through a few hoops so that, you know, you can show that you're sort of up to task and professional, yielding good results, and not misappropriating materials and things like that. It's not horrendously difficult, but there's a heck of a lot of paperwork, and fortunately, I'm mostly removed from that. I'm the lucky one that just gets to analyze and explore. Acquiring a representative sample is one thing that's kind of a natural extension of that. So suppose you do have full license to buy cannabis from a variety of sources. Where do you buy it from? And then what do you buy? There are all kinds of different types of this plant. So where do you start? What is a representative average sample of cannabis? And do methods change if we're looking, say, for example, for aromatic thiols that are contributing to this one particular plant's sort of flavor or aroma profile? Would that method of analysis change because it might have a higher thiol content than another plant? Would it be underrepresented in another one if we use the same techniques? That could all be true, and it's not well known. And so we will do tests, you know, internally on a large batch to say that this is kind of our representative measure, but it is going to change and grow for different types of plants. And then there's all kinds of different products, right? So it's a little bit difficult to get a license, and then it's difficult to sort of set your feet and say, okay, this is what we're going to study and what we're going to prove, and it's going to be easy, right? No problem. You have to be really judicious and careful and thoughtful on acquiring the license for exactly kind of, you know, what studies you aim to do. It is tricky. It should be. But consider that we have the opportunity to be able to do this, whereas many people around the world don't.
Absolutely. And I did hear, I don't know whether this is just one of these myths or legends that you hear, but I have seen past studies, quite a few of them, treat cannabis in a way that kind of shows a blatant lack of education for the plant, and just say lumping cannabis is cannabis. There's no description in the study about the THC content, other cannabinoids, terpene content. I do want to just touch on, you said thiol content. What is that?
Oh, yeah. Ah, yeah. Okay. So everybody, this is tip of, you know, that it's like a Reddit meme or whatever. It's the iceberg, and there's layers to the iceberg. And it's at the top, right? We could consider cannabinoids, terpenes, your limonene and myrcene. You know, everybody knows these specific molecules, but then we don't really talk about what's beneath the surface, which are novel cannabinoids, thiols that could give or contribute to some of the aroma. Thiols are sulfur containing compounds. They are usually pretty stinky. They're undoubtedly what contributes to that skunk smell in weed. So there are some assays of looking at the aromatic profiles of just those specific types of compounds, but not many. And with sort of selected targeted varieties of cannabis, or as you say, grouping it all as just cannabis. And yeah, there's a lot of, I wouldn't say misinformation, but just not full education, not enough awareness that there is quite a bit of diversity in this plant. And as we look at it and try to chemotype the plant, that is fully quantify all species in the plant, right? Everything, that's the goal in the end. As we chemotype these things and get a full evaluation that not just from plant to plant, but region to region or even day to day, that can vary in their chemical composition by quite a bit, I think we'll start to see more understanding that cannabis isn't just cannabis.
So just are thiols terpenes? Are they separate from terpenes? Where do they fit
into that? They're separate from terpenes. Yeah, they're separate from terpenes. They're actually a moiety. So they're a chemical moiety. So you could think like an oxygen-containing group. Everybody knows ethanol, right? It's in alcohol. That's a CH3, CH2, OH. So that OH on the end is an alcohol moiety or an alcohol chemical group. If you substitute that oxygen with an S, a sulfur, then you have a thiol. So they're a lot like alcohols in terms of their reactivity and behavior and chemical sort of properties, but also quite different, obviously, because they have a different heteroatom.
Wow, that's awesome. Less than 10 minutes in and already having my mind blown. So on the legal cannabis market in Canada today...
And no mushrooms required.
Well, no, maybe just a microdose, but yeah, no, not really. So we have THC and CBD are the two cannabinoids that are tested for on every cannabis product that you'll find in Canada today. More and more, we're seeing producers take that proactive step and start to post more information. So some of the more forward-looking suppliers and growers now are putting on the full cannabinoid profile, or let's say, maybe not the full one, but you know, some of the minor cannabinoids, up to around 10 of them, and the terpene profile as well. which is, you know, a great step in the right direction. But with that information on the packaging, would you say we are moving in the right direction, or would you say that, you know, I mean, clearly there's more to cannabis than just these things. So do you think we should be putting more information on that, on those packagings? Is there more to it than this?
I kind of wondered that myself as a chemist, right? Is what would you want to see on the packaging, on the label? And some things are really useful and interesting. So if you want to get an idea of how this cannabis is going to treat you, you know, what kind of experience will you get out of this? You know, if you look at beer, or I think wine might have a similar metric too, but they have IBUs on beer, international bitterness, you know, I think. And it gives you an idea of not all IPAs here are the same. I'm looking at a variety, and this one's quite a bit more bitter. It might be even sour or whatever, you know. What kind of a beer do I want tonight? Do I want something that's a little more smooth drinking, or do I want something with a bit of a sharp hop flavor? And I think that that's what you get out of these terpene profiles. And then out of the cannabinoid profile, you can kind of begin to gauge. You can start targeting your own application. If you want to be more relaxed, if you just want to get the munchies, if you want to have just a laugh, giggle session, if you have persistent, constant anxiety, you might want to be looking at things that are high in different levels of different cannabinoids. And as more research comes out about what these cannabinoids might be aimed or good for, or what have you, that's all good information to have. Consider if you're going to get a pharmaceutical for your anxiety and you try a bunch of different medicines, you know exactly what dosage and exactly what you're taking every single time. And that's how the doctor can inform inform you and improve your diagnosis and improve your treatment, right? If you're going in and looking to just have fun, that's all you want, and you know that's very high THC flower or something like that, and this specific variety has CBG and CBD and other levels of terpenes and other compounds, you might think, oh, okay, like, we're getting a more targeted experience here. I'm not buying undistilled tequila. I'm buying something like a nice single malt scotch. You can get a better idea of what you're buying and whether it's worth paying for. I think all of this is really good information for the customer in any way you look at it. You don't have that same kind of advantage when you go down to buy a beer, but you have all kinds of historical evidence of IPAs taste like this and lagers taste like that. But we can't even agree on things like sativa and indica and different effects like that, because it's such a personal thing. And I think that having all of that information doesn't need to be overload, right? But having additional information like that is really handy for the consumer, and also good for the producer. They can get an idea of what their customers enjoy, right? So yeah, I think that we should go toward more information is better, but you know, it's obviously, I think, a given play. Too much information overload is just more information. People will ignore the nutrition facts on the side of some things, right? But if you give them a better better first step, I think that's all good. Yes, absolutely.
That's a good point. You don't want to overload consumers with stuff that is meaningless to them as well. So, which actually segues nicely onto, you see, I think I've got a packet here. Okay. So I got a pack of weed here.
Oh yeah.
And I'm hoping you can help me with the format of the packaging, because it doesn't just tell you, you know, the THC percentage. It tells you THC and then total THC and then THC total. And you have a bunch of different milligram per grams on here. So, you know, I think a lot of people are very used to just having like a percentage on their packet. And this is maybe a little bit confusing to some people. I did see like a little bit of talk about it. Yeah.
It's confusing to me, and I'm an analytical chemist. You know, that number is, those numbers are so misleading, in my opinion. It doesn't have the same kind of weight. Statistical way, I mean, it doesn't have the same kind of accuracy that something like 40% whiskey would have. They have a pretty razor thin tolerance for what they can have, or rather, at least they know what their precision on their measurement is, whereas cannabinoid measurement can swing quite a bit depending on how the analysis is done and what testing lab's doing it and where and how they handle their samples. And I don't see any error bars on those. I don't see any error bars. And is it dry mass? Is it wet mass? When is it? When is the mass taken? How is it harvested? What is the complete and total procedure for how this is measured? The fact is it can vary a little bit, and those numbers are good, right? You can trust them to some degree, but I think that we're not fully at a state with cannabis analytics where we can make hard measures like that and put it in package it in a medical way and be absolutely certain that we know exactly how much is in there, because it varies a little bit. We also don't know how shelf life affects it for every product out there. So those numbers could be wild. If you buy something from last year and it's not perfectly stored and it's been in a warm room, who the heck knows what you're buying, right? I don't care what the label says. That was when it was tested, but how was it tested? So I would like to see a lot more transparency on that. And I would like to see a standard methods for cannabis analysis that is globally accepted, not to micro markets or countries or things like that. We need to know exactly how this analysis is done to be able to compare apples to apples, right? So I'm maybe pessimistic about the number on the label there, right? Because what I'm saying is it really does vary. Even how you store it at home, it will vary, right? So whereas something like a bottle of whiskey, you can be fairly confident it's quite stable. This is not the same product and it has to be treated a bit differently. And so that's, I think, something that we're really helping with and what we can address is one of the biggest pieces of low-hanging fruit to me is we don't have like standard methods. We don't have very, very, very robust methods for analysis of all cannabinoids in all products. We're moving towards this as time goes on, and I think that we're helping a lot with that. But the thing is, there is not just variation in the plant, there's also variation in how it's prepared and how different products are made. So that will be something big, I think, in the future. We might be able to perfectly map out the chemical composition of a joint or something like that. However, how a producer has prepared their oil or how they have prepared their gummies or what have you can introduce new byproducts that we've never seen before. So we have to be sort of constantly vigilant and looking for different things that we're not even expecting.
Yeah, it's actually crazy. I wonder how much variance there can be between labs, because I do know it's commonplace for producers to shop around for their cannabis testing and terpene testing, and then they'll just go with the highest number.
Yes.
Which is just a little bit crazy.
Yeah. I like to say my job as an analytical chemist is to sort of be the bearer of bad news, because I'm giving you a real answer with statistics to show you that this is how the measurement was performed. And you can be angry, you can be sad that you don't have what you want, but at the end of the day, I can't lie to you because that's exactly what the stats are telling me, and I can do no different, right? On the other hand, some labs can just change the number in the Excel spreadsheet, and there you go, right? I have a complete like disgust and distaste for labs that do this, because we're trying to get at the truth here as scientists, and you're mucking it up when you do stuff like that. And not only new and interesting therapeutics can be found accidentally with bad data, you know, or seemingly bad data, but research can improve on the accurate data only. So this is why I don't take a lot of stock in reported values like that. If I'm not seeing error bars, if I'm not seeing other testing and how they've evaluated their method. That's me as an analytical scientist, though. I tend to not trust anything, right? Unless I let me see
the
data.
So what are
the
error bars?
The error bars vary depending on your matrix. So depending on what sample you're analyzing, depends on what instrument you've used to analyze. Let's say that I'm looking at some data right now that we were doing in the lab. What we were trying to find was, this is actually a great topic. I was just looking at this today. Okay, so this actually ties in perfectly. We were looking at milling methods recently. So how do you bust your weed? As a user, you might have a grinder or something like that, right? Some heavy users might even have a little coffee mill that they use to bust up their weed. in a lab, it's actually not too much different from that. You'll find a lot of labs might actually just use a coffee mill to bust up their weed, and there you go. You extract it out and measure the solution. And in that solution, in measuring that, based on how you've done your extraction, how you've done your sample prep, that will dictate how precise your value is at the end, right? A lot of labs will take standard methods for other plants. So like my comparison with cannabis is usually hops and hops analysis in beer, right? It's a very common and sort of similar, just inconsistency type plant. So it's something to look at or to learn from, right? You pick up techniques and adjust them for the specific analyte that you're looking at. But a lot of them will take that method that just uses maybe a coffee grinder to bust out the weed and call it a day, extract it in some alcohol and run it. And there's your measurement. Super precise. Looks great every time, but it doesn't actually represent the true value. So it's this interplay as well of precision, how close your grouping is on the dartboard, and accuracy, how close you are to that bullseye. You have to look at each stage of sample prep to gauge how accurate and how precise the workflow is, and how accurate and how precise your analysis for cannabinoids would be in this case. And in ours, in our best case, after evaluating coffee grinders and professional grinders that you see in labs like Fritsch mills and bladed grinders and ball mills and things like this, comparing between just busting it up by hand and preparing the mill, where you have control over how fast the blade moves and the speed of the mill and the heat that's generated, the difference in results is shocking. you can obviously destroy cannabis with heat and the frictional heat that is developed inside of a coffee mill. And as you destroy these cannabinoids in the sample, you reduce your accuracy. It's forming other products that you can't see. That can also affect your precision too, right? Precision can also be just sort of a measure of how messy your workstation is, right? If you are working with a very complex sample like cannabis, you have to be as clean and pristine, you know, as you possibly can to ensure good precision. So anyway, all of that is to say our precision on our recent quantification here with following studying these milling techniques, following our study of different extraction techniques, is less than 1%. It's 0.323% relative standard deviation, looking at batches of extracts of the same flower. That's pretty good. That's kind of what I would expect with an HPLC analysis. You want really good precision, but also quality accuracy, and ours is also below 1%. So not only are we tightly grouped, we're also close on target. So that's a very good measurement, a very good result. But that is with one specific type of flower with only a couple types of grinders and one type of extraction. And there are hundreds of types of flower and hundreds, and if not more, types of extractions and you know, a million different ways to prepare a sample. So this needs to be evaluated and gauged for your workflow and for your analysis. So we're doing that to get our absolute best measurement that we possibly can for cannabinoids. However, we are not a testing lab and we don't have thousands and thousands of samples to get through. So the interplay here is we as a CRO are able to play around and have very high quality methods and develop very high quality methods that can be used by those labs. But those labs don't normally have the time to invest to develop an absolutely perfect method like we do. So they will... you know, their methods will inherently struggle a little bit and not be quite as accurate. So what are the error bars on there? I don't know. I really don't know. I would love to see what they are. I can't even guess because I don't know how they do their analysis and I haven't evaluated it myself. I guess our analysis is quite good, right? But it's tough to say for someone else and for different flowers, for different products, it can vary by quite a bit. Which is something else as far as customer education that I think is important. Sometimes you might try something and have no effect, and you try the same exact product and you think, whoa, you know, this is a totally different experience. And that could be part of the answer, right? It's a somewhat inhomogeneous plant, and this kind of thing can happen.
Mm. Lots of people still shopping with the highest THC number, so which it's good for people to know that that may indeed be a bit of nonsense.
I think it's complete nonsense. I think
I shop for THC, but in the opposite way. Oh, yeah. You know, if I see a nice like 1-to-1 or something, I'm I'm always drawn to that.
That is sort of what we have the power to do now, right? Say in the UK, you just go find your friend and he might have some and you pay 20 quid for it and there you go. And you get what you get. You have no idea what that could be. What a terrifying situation and in my opinion, what a waste of money. Here we can say, I want something that's going to relax me without being too psychoactive and not, put me in the couch or what have you. One-to-one is like a fair enough relative comparison that we can trust that those measurements are good enough to say that that's roughly the competition we're getting in. You can shop around now. You can look and source flour that is specific and tailored to your needs. And that's just two cannabinoids. That's just two. We have so much more to analyze and investigate in the plant and how it affects people to then start, I think, suggesting and marketing things better.
So you're not only testing substances, you're also carrying out your own research. You're working with clients to help with methodologies to ensure accuracy and consistency of results.
We do quite a bit of stuff. So we work with producers for those types of methods and developing those types of methods so that they can ensure that their results are accurate, that their results are the best or tuned specifically for their needs, right? But we do a lot of our own fundamental research on our own instrumentation to ensure that we are getting the absolute best value out of our analyses, which we can then use to help customers out, right? So another producer may be interested in the variation that they get in their plant that can indicate different trends in their harvest or crop. Another producer might just want to know, is my extract working? Am I getting the types of compounds that I want out of here? And then other clients we've had are preparing synthetic materials, and those are really a grab bag. It could be anything in here, and they just want to know what those unknowns are. So that kind of untargeted analysis, we have absolutely no idea what we're looking for, but we need to know what's in there and how much. That's my favorite question, and a very difficult and complicated one in analytical chemistry, and something we're able to do. Again, that an ISO certified testing lab just does not have time or facility for.
That's very cool. Kind of blank canvas. You tell me what's
carte blanche. Exactly. Yeah. So we do a lot of bespoke tailored work for clients depending on what their needs are. Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about vaping, actually. And I'm just curious if you've done any research or you're aware of anything in this area. And, let me just clarify that because I'm big into my dry herb vaporizers. So on one hand, you have those.
Dry herb, let's say you mean?
Most of them are convection.
Oh, yes. Yeah, right. Yep.
So they're essentially, you fill a chamber with some milled cannabis flower and you turn on the machine, and whether it's generated by flame or through electricity or whatever, it's going to heat up, pass hot air through the chamber, and you're extracting the cannabinoids, the terpenes through there. I'm a big advocate of that, but then, so I want to touch on, get your thoughts on that, but then also the vaping, which a lot of people are probably more familiar with, which are the extracts in the cartridges with the little 5-10 pens, and probably a bit to get into there, but I know there's been controversy around vaping related illnesses with that kind of thing, and botanical terpenes versus cannabis extracts. So what are your thoughts, Eric?
This is like Pandora's box. We have so much to talk about. But to start, I'm so happy you mentioned that, because I forgot to mention that we have a smoking robot in our lab. That's one of the coolest things that I get to say about our lab is in addition to not really fully understanding the plant and having lots of chemical analysis work to do there, there is a lot of, if I smoke a joint with something in it, or if I smoke a joint that's heavily packed, or if I smoke with mixed flower, what am I actually inhaling? There is not a lot of inhalation analysis in cannabis yet. And in tobacco, they have been and they have to measure this, of course. So they have these pneumatic robots that simulate a lung. They pull in, they draw in air, and they smoke the cigarette down. You collect the products that are inhaled and then analyze them on your instrumentation to see what's in there. And it's a much more accurate representation of what you're actually ingesting as a consumer, right? We also have the ability to do this with a vape. So you can have it trigger the vape and inhale, and we analyze the byproducts, or sorry, what's emitted from the vape. And so far, talking health is tricky because the samples that we see may be contaminated or they may be synthetic. And so it's tough for me to say that, you know, be alarmist about this, right? Because I see some of the worst, or I think I've seen some of the worst, or read about some of the worst and things like that. In general, a lot of the distillates and things like that that are vape quality, they seem just fine. They're a concentrated form of the material. I think some of the danger there is with the concentration of low-level contaminants that are really toxic, like metals, heavy metals and things like that. And I guess in my mind, I think of the two, the raw plant, raw material, and the distilled variety as like, you know, beer as cannabis flower, and then whiskey or something like that is the condensed form, the vaporizer. And so I think like from a health point of view, it's really easy to just drain a vape cartridge if you just hold the button down and start inhaling. And that can make someone extremely, incredibly ill. And not only that, it can also expose them to higher, like elevated amounts of metals if they were to ingest more faster, if you know what I mean, right? So something that was a low level toxicity issue could crop up if they go through it really fast. So
the rate of inhalation is having a big impact on possible health implications.
I think that is a consideration. I think that it's easier to regulate, I think, your dose if you are using, you know, as homogenized as possible flower, and you roll your own joints and you kind of know what you're getting each time. When you buy a vape cartridge, there is usually like, you know, it's been tested. It shouldn't be quite as variable, but it could have gone off. There could have been an issue with manufacturing or something like that. And sometimes contamination gets into the cartridge. And that is what worries me more. It's not so much that you're exposing yourself to too much cannabis. You know, you'll be sick and then you'll get over it, right? But for the most part. But what I'm worried about is accumulated doses of something like metals in vape cartridges, because of the rate of inhalation might be unexpectedly higher with those than with something like a joint. So this is something that we have the ability to look at, and we haven't done a study on metals specifically yet, but what we've done is looked at cannabinoid recovery from vape cartridges as they are inhaled, cannabinoid recovery from joints, and in different sections of the joint. So where in the joint are you getting the most THC, where are you getting the most terpenes evolved throughout the joint? So, for example, at the base end, the what do they call it? The crotch of the joint. I've heard that term used at that end.
Yeah, I call it like the roach or the ends.
I always just call it the tip, but I didn't see anything wrong with that. But our boss was calling it the crotch, so I guess so. We'll go with that.
I like that.
But the tip at the end there, you have all this cannabinoid oil that sort of has concentrated and condensed as the joint has been smoked. And so a lot of the cannabinoids are actually at the base, at the end.
Don't tell me that.
I know, right? Because it's the worst.
Half-smoked joints, I'm like, nah.
I mean, it's a relatively, you know, more abundant amount. I would still say quality over quantity any day, right?
Well, yeah, I'd have thought surely there would be less terpenes, though. I mean, it never tastes as good.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we're saying, is that it just looks like ashy junk, right? But, of course, it has a higher elevated concentration of cannabinoids at the end, because it's sort of like running a hot call, like a hot gas column, and concentrating these cannabinoids down at the end. So those brave soldiers that go for the last hit on the joints, you know, they're going for a reason, I think.
They know something we all didn't.
Exactly. So things like that, we still have to explore. We have the ability to do this, though, and we can take a look at vape cartridges, and we do regularly. I haven't seen anything that alarms me or anything like that, but the Avali crisis and things like that, you know, I think that the abuse of the material in that form is still a greater possibility than with just raw dried flour, just because of the volume. It's like leaving someone alone with a bottle, like I said, like with a bottle of concentrated spirits or whiskey versus one beer. It's going to be a totally different party. So we need to really make sure that the more like the vapes are very, very, very stringently analyzed for anything that is contaminating, and any novel or...
By Health Canada.
Yeah. Like Health Canada really needs to step up in terms of this kind of more comprehensive analysis of these products, because we don't know too much about them and they're for sale. So they're for sale and sanctioned by Health Canada. So I would expect a little more, thoroughness.
Do you get any kind of like funding made available through the government? Because from my perspective, you know, I see so much cash has been raised from legalization. The stuff that you're talking about here to me is of critical importance. If I was the government, I would be taking some of that cash to put back into funding these kind of research and tests so we can all understand.
We haven't received funding from them, right? We haven't received any kind of government funding where it's completely private enterprise. However, they have, we've worked with them in the past on different things. I have FOMO. I want them to work with us so much more, right? Because I really think about this a lot, like roadside testing, or how do you determine impairments, and how does somebody know what dose they're getting? That's really important, and not really, I don't really see a lot of progress towards that, just a little bit. And so I think if I could get into Health Canada and get inside their office and talk to them, you know, I feel like I have a lot that I would want to collaborate with them on and talk about, because we're sort of more boots on the ground and they're managing the regulatory aspect of this. And there's a lot more to that than my job, which is relatively simple, which is just measuring things. And so I want to, as we continue our research and work, be speaking with them closely, so that we go forward in the right direction and nobody's getting hurt, nobody's getting harmed, and we have quality scientific evidence to back up what we see in this plan.
Let's talk about mushrooms a little bit, because you mentioned you're doing a full spectrum cannabis breakdown, you know, finding all the elements in there. When we talk about mushrooms, psilocybin is the THC, I guess everyone's known,
knows exactly.
It. Psilocin, a little bit less well known, but still pretty well known. I'm gonna just go out on a limb here and say that this is just the tip of the iceberg again.
Oh my. So I mean, my background was in organometallic chemistry, metal complexes, things that I thought were fairly complex, you know, fairly tricky things to analyze. Mushrooms are a completely new world. And I mean, plants are too. Just plant analysis in general is a tricky field. There's so much that can interfere. And like I say, getting a representative sample is tricky, and homogenizing it is difficult. There's a lot of thinking involved. Mushrooms are a beautifully complex substance. Beautifully complex. No wonder people are excited about this. There is so much to find in just the handful of samples that I've analyzed. There's so much to talk about and so much to explore just on a couple analyses, just on a couple mass spec experiments. We see all kinds of really interesting biomolecules that I was expecting to see, but the complexity is really apparent. What I think will be tricky with mushrooms will be much, 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 much more tricky with mushrooms is the same kind of problem we have with cannabis, is determining representative values, getting quality analyses in place. I read somewhere that there was no accepted immunoassay for psilocybin or psilocin. So meaning if I take 100 grams of mushrooms and I go to the hospital, they wouldn't have a standard test to be able to ensure that that was psilocybin that I had taken, which I thought, whoa, is that true? I haven't been able to find a standard method for psilocybin and psilocin analysis. And there are methods now, as it becomes more and more popular, looking at it. We've published one that's a quick high throughput analysis, but there's almost nothing. I mean, almost nothing. I don't think I've really had this experience as a scientist where I just cannot find literature anywhere. So that's alarming. Not only are these things incredibly complicated and we don't know anything about the suppression effects and the different interfering molecules that may be in there, the things that could suppress our measurements or not give us an accurate or precise value, we don't know anything about those. We also don't have good methods for just analyzing the compounds themselves. So psilocybin and psilocin as pure substances, we don't have perfect methods of making them. We don't have perfect methods of purifying them. This is like, speaking of low-hanging fruit, you know, they're mushrooms popping out of the ground in this analogy, right? There is so much work to do on this. It is fascinating. And again, something that has been really taboo and regulated and quiet and not a huge culture around, or really sort of subdued compared to other plants and things like this. There are other methods of mushroom analyses for different things, but those really advanced studies where they pull apart the genetics and complexity of a mushroom haven't been done on psilocybin mushrooms. And we're about to. So I'm really excited about that. What we do for a go on. I should let you talk a little bit, right? I get too excited.
Oh, no, I shouldn't really, because you're far more interesting. I was just going to say, does the technology exist in the mycology realm that's been used for the abundance of other mushrooms, and that's coming in now to
exactly.
Psilocybin.
So the technology exists, but because it's been so underground and quiet, you know, forever, the methods that you can find for analyses, like standard methods or well-developed analytical methods, are from the 80s. They didn't have things like artificial intelligence techniques to guide their data analysis, and they didn't have the computational power to be able to do large database searches to do kind of like untargeted analyses. We have so much power now, it is now just turning on this, you know, for all intents and purposes, newly discovered mushroom that we can just apply everything to and learn something new and find new compounds and really explore. It's like a kid in a candy shop over here. So that's why I get so excited about this, is that there is a lot to do, obviously a lot of work, but you know, almost anything that we try out here is going to be helpful, I think. And we're a pretty smart bunch of people and developing really cool methods that someone can use in a clinical setting. I don't have any medical expertise. I don't know how this is going to affect you, but from my reading, boy, what an exciting time it is to be a researcher here, because I think that our work will help develop this new field of psychology, of psychedelic assisted therapy. It'll be so exciting to see how that develops and to be at the front lines, ensuring that we're getting quality medicine or therapeutics to people, not, you know, dried mushrooms from who knows where. We will also be able to start exploring other compounds that might be useful in a therapeutic sense for someone. It might help someone down the line without giving them a crazy trip where they see that the walls are breathing or something. You know, it'll just be a therapeutic aid. There's a lot that we can find in here. There's a lot going on in these mushrooms. Like I said, they're incredibly complex. There's way more to them than just psilocybin and psilocin. I just cannot wait to start pulling it apart and investigating these things and see what we can find out.
Wow, that is super exciting. You know, I'll be honest, the last couple years I've lost a little bit of faith in science, or not in science, but in our ability to execute science in a truly unbiased, open, transparent way that's free from like political interference and so on and so forth. But you know, talking to you here, it seems like your ethos is very much like truly science-based, which is, you know, not trying to get to X solution, but just to follow the path to the end of the road, so that you've seen and laid a roadmap out for what it is, irregardless of what that looks like or what the implications may be. I think that's desperately what we need.
I think
more
so too. I'm happy that I mean, that's what I try to do every day. I can't lie, is what I say. I only tell you what my experiment has shown. I can only tell you what the numbers tell me. To that end, it makes life a lot easier. I can only give you the best job, and I can prove to you that this number is as close as we can get, right? That kind of shuts down anything like, oh, you didn't do a good job. Kind of shuts down that conversation if I can give you the statistics to back it up. And we don't have them for this, obviously, so there's a lot to do here to start generating like trustworthy data. But that's what we need, I think, in science and in most industries, is somebody looking at it with a kind of like unbiased. It's not that I don't care, but it's that it doesn't affect me at all if this value is higher than the other one or what have you. That research is for somebody else, but I just want to make sure that it's accurate. Because if it's accurate, then we can start talking. If it's accurate, then we aren't going to make mistakes that we've made in the past. So that's more important to me. If it's terrible, if psilocybin is the worst idea for therapy ever conceived, so be it. That's not for me to say. That's beyond my pay grade. I just measure things. I just want to make sure that it's accurate.
But then it gets so difficult, yes, like we've seen with cannabis, where people have a bad experience with cannabis, and therefore, because there's historically been a political agenda to demonize cannabis, the act of someone having a bad experience is therefore proof that cannabis is a harmful and dangerous medicine with little to no medicinal value. The
mantra, I guess, we have to get rid of cars. UK, we have to get rid of vehicles, because if that's the case,
that's true.
That's always.
Yeah, I got food poisoning once as well.
Just get rid of
all food. It's got to go.
That kind of BS argument is what I live to crush. Like, as a scientist, I love seeing that crap floating around, and then you get to come in with data and say, no, you're wrong. And if you have data, please show me, right? That's how we should be talking about this. But there's also obviously a lot of value in the anecdotal experiences and things, right? Which this is why I ended up not going into, say, psychology, right? That's a subjective and tricky minefield to me. It's very tough that problem to solve is, will psilocybin help you get over PTSD? Will it help you with your alcoholism? Will it help you with your anxiety and stress or existential dread? I don't know. You know, it's worked for some people, and there's a lot of promising evidence. And if it works for one person, I'm happy. You know, but I also can't lie if it's something that has done something catastrophic to someone. That is also really good information. The tendency is to see something terrible and knee jerk, say, ban it, get rid of it, it's all bad. But the truth is that not every solution is for everyone. Not one size fits all here. And that, I think, is reflected in also how sort of like underground and misunderstood that psilocybin mushrooms are. I think you have some people that it's the world to them, and it really matters, and it just changed their life. And those people should have access to it, and they should be allowed and assisted, you know, like to be able to make their life better. It's not hurting anybody. Some people have terrifying, dreadfully terrifying experiences. Call it a day, say it's not for them, and get on with their lives. And so be it, right? If you don't like it, don't do it. If you didn't have a good time, don't do it. However, do you need to also ruin the party for everybody else? There is, you know, if you take an antipsychotic drug, it might not do something good to you. It might do something really terrible. But on the other side of the spectrum, someone needs that to function as a human being. So we need to get away from this, like, oh, I had a bad time once, and therefore it's all bad. You know, like, come on, let's take some statistics into account and see how people like it. If we aggregate real data, true data, and get the statistics on it, I think you'd be surprised that it does help a lot more people than it hurts. But we need to prove that.
And as we understand more about how it's used, then that, like with cannabis, the amount of positive outcomes gets bigger and the amount of negative outcomes, yes, becomes smaller, simply because we're using it in better ways.
The comparison with alcohol always breaks down pretty quick, because that's been around since Neolithic times, and it's a human staple. Like, it's not going anywhere, and the comparison is difficult. But if the alcohol were developed today, it wouldn't get past FDA standards because it's poison. Whereas now we're sort of developing cannabis as like consumer packaged goods and pharmaceuticals almost, or literally in the case of Sativax and things like this. That has a heck of a lot more stringent people like me analyzing these things. Whereas beer could have all kinds of junk in it, and that's just the quality of the beer, right? That's how they've made their beer, and for 100 years, and the way it's going to be. Now we have this opportunity here to really focus in on what the key, like the good aspects are, and use and learn from those, and develop new stuff off of that. If all of this is terrible, the worst that we can do is learn from it and improve other areas. Right, it's that argument for taking action for or against climate change. It's like, what if we clean up our parks and make the world a better place for no reason? Right, it'd be awful.
God, that would be
awful.
We've
wasted our time. So it's like, if we analyze it and it turns out to be terrible, we're still on. You know, we don't need to pick sides. We're just picking the truth, and we're just trying to figure out what's going on here. We can talk about whether it's good or bad, or whether you want your kids to smoke it or whatever later, but let's just make sure that we know what we're talking about first, and that we've done our due scientific diligence.
It's the basis for informed discussion, and truly, truly important. And in that sense, there's no, like, a good outcome can be a negative or a positive outcome, because you're, whatever it is, like when you make mistakes in life, you learn from it, and you know, you move on from that. It's not always easy. So I think that's just great wisdom to live by. You know, we need to be less tribal, despite social media and all these things really getting us into that. We all have, we're only human, but I try and say these things out loud to remind myself, like, you know, less tribal, less attached to the outcome, and taking the ego out of it, and just observing to build up trusted information.
Absolutely. It's, for me as an analytical chemist, statistics are really important. So I'll hand someone a measurement and they'll say, whoa, there's no X, Y, Z in here. We were expecting a lot of that. And I say, well, this was my one analysis, right? You know, I would suggest we do this a couple times. You can't, you know, when you're joining, if you're a carpenter or whatever, you measure twice and then cut once. You don't measure once and then call it a day. That's how errors pop up. Same thing with analytical chemistry. If we measure something, right, if it's just a single test, we should do it a few times to make sure that it's correct. So I try not to take one lab's bad set of results, in my opinion, right, and say, oh, all cannabis methods are terrible. That's an easy trap to fall in as a scientist and as an analytical scientist. I think that we're developing methods and they're getting better and better, but it sometimes is difficult when I see, you know, the mommy blogs or the people who are just trying to do high throughput, get the sample analyzed kind of science, you know, just trying to analyze the sample. Their motives are a bit different, but it doesn't contribute to the story in my mind. Like, we need to focus on high quality data, and a lot of it, more and more and more and more of it, is a better way to make an argument. If I saw 30 terrible methods, then that is a better case of seeing one terrible method and saying that they're all bad. But it lends support. That's scientific thinking. And it's tough to, as a human, I think, it's tough to just sort of ignore your intuition and try to think, well, wait a minute, is this really what's going on? Considering everything else that I know or other things that I can research, is this really what I think is happening, right? It's really important to check yourself. It's tough for me as a scientist. It's something that we have to remind ourselves of regularly. And it's even more difficult to get that into the mind of a consumer or somebody who's maybe new to this area, that, you know, the measurement you see on the front of your packaging, that is a measurement. There's an error associated with it. And we don't really know exactly what that is because they haven't told you. They also haven't told you how it's analyzed and so on and so forth. So we have to kind of estimate what the error could be here. But you see the measurement and you think, 5.9%. Okay, that's what I'm getting, right? That's what it says on the label. It's very easy to do that. But in our field, it's more fruitful to kind of just average things out, collect more information, collect more data before you make sort of like solid
that makes sense. And I think from a consumer perspective, what we can do is not take any one piece of information as gospel, but combine all of the info on the packet. So, you know, like the packed on date. Okay, well, fortunately, I know companies can just repackage stuff and update their packaging date. But I know now
I suppose that's true.
Companies aren't putting the harvest date on there. You know, Shelter Cannabis pioneered with that. So companies like Organicraft, for example, they have the package date, the harvest date, the name of the grower, the salt-based nutrients that they were using, the cure, the dry time. And you start to see then, like,
that's amazing.
Yeah, there's nowhere to hide, right? With all of that info, you can build up a good picture of the cannabis. So yeah, we'll have more like that.
I think it's good for everybody because nobody's going to look at it and go, oh, this is only dried for 30 minutes. I'm not going to buy this brand anymore. It's just like, oh, okay. Like I get an idea of the process that's going in here and I get an idea of the experience I'm getting into here. If you put on a bottle of whiskey and say smoky, it doesn't mean anything. But if I give you a value of like how smoky it is and how we've made it, then you can kind of get an idea before you pull the trigger on that expensive bottle or what have you.
True that.
Yeah, so I'm so looking forward to that, and because we're in 2022 and it's more modern and it's being analyzed thoughtfully, or sorry, it's being developed thoughtfully as a product, I hope it maintains that course. We'll see stuff like that. You'll have deep dive, whatever you want to see. I think some growers might have like very detailed information about who grew it from what genetic parents and how they've treated it from beginning, like from farm to table, right? What batch was it? When was it grown? What fertilizers were used? Is it organic soil or not? Like all these things would be nice to know. They're not critical, but say you have a QR code on your package, you can scan it and get a quick like breakdown of exactly what you're buying. I think that's so easy. Well, I shouldn't say it's so easy to do these days, right? It's obviously significant in development and investment effort and testing. And, you know, you might have to work with us and we can help you develop these methods to get that on your packaging, right? But I think that is looking at leafly, those radar plots of different cannabinoids and different terpenes and things like that. That's information that customers want to have. And we're somewhat entitled to it these days. I think that we should have that information available. And I think that's the way that we're going. More comprehensive analyses to have a more informed customer and a better experience for everybody.
Agreed. So Eric, I got one more question for you on mushrooms, purely for educational purposes. What's the most optimal way of taking psilocybin mushrooms so they're at their peak potency?
So like peak potency, in my opinion, it needs to be an absolutely freshly picked mushroom at its peak production period. I forget exactly when this is. The different species have different peak productions, something else that we need to look at, right? We could monitor the growth of mushrooms over time and gauge when the best harvest would be. So if you want the most bang for your buck, right, you harvest then and you gotta take it immediately, like right away, like right as soon as it's pulled from the ground or wherever it's being grown, because psilocybin is actually a prodrug. Psilocin is a dephosphorylated version of psilocybin. So that's the psychoactive one. But psilocybin itself, it readily dephosphorylates. It readily decomposes, if you will, into this prodrug. If you look at it funny, if you store it in a hot room, if you crush it in your hands, you know, it starts to degrade. Like everything else, like most other organic materials, it does have like a lifetime, a shelf time, but it's much shorter than a lot of other things. So don't put it in tea. There's this thing I was taught recently called lemon teching. It's you drop psilocybin into hot lemon tea. I don't know exactly the full medical effect of this yet, but I can tell you that 100% it will dephosphorylate psilocybin into psilocin. Does that change the trip or the... I don't know. That's coming. But you're degrading your compound by doing that. Take it fresh. There are other ways of like storing it to get around this and to avoid it that we're looking into to preserve psilocybin, to avoid it going off in the mushroom itself. But generally, I would say if you want peak potency, either extract it right away into something and stabilize it and freeze it. So you can do it like a tincture or an alcohol extract or other organic solvents and extract it into that and work it up and all that. Or just take it fresh. those are, I think, in my opinion, right now, from what I know, the best way to get the most bang for your buck out of psilocybin. Because as soon as we start processing it, as soon as you mill it down or grind it up or anything, it's shocking how quickly this thing degrades. It is shocking. It actually doesn't surprise me that you get such a mix of experiences and opinions, because the variation is truly unknowable at this rate or at this stage. I think it's a substantial component of mixed opinions, but I need to do some more research to find out exactly what could be going on here.
Very interesting. Yeah, entirely anecdotally, I always like to pluck one fresh mushroom from the substrate and eat it fresh, and it always seems to pack a really nice punch. I often drive for microdosing.
That's,
and,
I think, the way to go.
You know, like, the potency is not quite as important then, but yeah, it definitely feels a little bit less potent. The one time I did try a tea, it was quite interesting. Like, I got a full experience, but there were really like a complete lack of any visuals, which was a shame because I enjoy that aspect of it. So it was like, maybe it was like a little bit less full spectrum than normal. But again, like, we know there's so many variables and things going on.
That is true. I wonder, though, if it's because of that cursory dephosphorylation of the prodrug to psilocin that you get like a modulated effect. So it has to enter your bloodstream at a controlled rate or something. That might affect the experience overall. And it may inhibit to some degree the wild trips, the really tough things to deal with. So I wonder if that's why people initially started doing this and still use this lemon teching technique. But I just don't know enough. I'm still learning and still exploring. And I hope to have some data to back this up to, like, shortly, right? So something that we'll be looking into.
I think the prevailing, like, folklore with lemon tech is that people use it because the onset of effect is quicker than if you were to just eat and go. So it kind of bypasses the digestory tract in some way, which I think has some credence to it. But yeah, it's interesting when we talk about the trade-off between the degradation of molecules in there and how that may affect the trip. So
it's a wild biomolecular pathway that the thing must take to, like, and how it would be modulated depending on the form is really cool. That's not something that you have access to with a lot of pharmaceuticals, so I can't wait to see what people do with it, to be honest. It's been interesting to a challenge to analyze, but it's been really interesting to study.
Yeah, that's incredible. My only downside to this whole movement currently is just the cost of access to do these things, not only legally, but in a setting with a therapist there. And I think, you know, it's $5,000 or around that for a course of ketamine over like a 12-week period in Vancouver, I think, or around that amount, which it's, you know, like I say, it's for people that need it most. It may be out of reach. And that's a shame.
That's unfortunate. That is really unfortunate. I'm not sure how much, like, what it's valued at, but I can tell you it was really difficult for us to just get a supply of fresh mushrooms to do our analyses on, for example, right? It's, despite the fact they grow naturally around campus or whatever, right? It's tough to just, it's tough for us as a business just to get a hold of them, even with our license and everything. So what makes me sad is that, you know, this might be a therapeutic that's coming. I wonder about those people that are suffering currently that don't have access to other things and would like to try something, right? To some alternative, and there's this like promising one on the horizon, but there's always some promise on the horizon. I just would like this to develop faster for those people so that we might get something for them, right? It's just going to move, I think, at the speed of business. We got to make sure that it's safe for people to take. It's safe that, you know, that no one's going to be adversely affected. That's more of a concern to me than treatment sometimes, right? So we need to learn more about it, I think, before everybody jumps on the bandwagon and starts microdosing, right? Because it may not be perfect for you. But it is really promising. It is really interesting. It gets me excited every day I wake up and think about this stuff. So we got to do it right, though. Got to do it safe.
Well, it sounds like you're definitely on the right track with the core values and what you're doing with Dilik Labs. Eric, thank you so much for joining me. I hope you've all enjoyed listening to this as much as I have. learn a bunch of new stuff, which is awesome. Do go check out their website. I'll put a link into the show notes as always, but there's some really good information on there about some of the stuff that they're doing, and also some educative articles and whatnot as well. So yeah, great resource to check out. And thanks again, Eric.
Thank you so much, Francis.